For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Well, welcome. This will be the last of the workshops, so welcome to all of you who are joining our class students here. Today we had it listed as Lessons from Mission History. Each of the students wrote a paper on, from their reading, what they felt to be the three most significant lessons that we can learn for doing missions today from history. And so I wanted to, that's not going to be for the whole time. I'm guessing it'll be 5, 10, 15 minutes. I wanted to, just so it'll end up being on the recording, I wanted to open it up first to our students, if others of you have something that you would like to add as well. But I would ask the students to speak into the mic, and then it will end up. By the way, Elaine, have we pressed this? Okay, all right. So that it will end up being on the tape. Okay? So what we, all of you students, not just from maybe what you wrote in your paper, but from what you have also hopefully learned as well this week, would someone from the student group like to start with what they consider to be one, just not too global, just one narrow piece, one lesson from missions history that has relevance for how we do missions today? Okay, Debbie.
I thought it was interesting, especially that William Carey said as part of his principles that he adopted that the indigenous church and an indigenous ministry had to come into being as quickly as possible. And I looked at that whole historical example of bringing in indigenous people, and you bring it forward to today's culture, and we struggle with having equal partnerships with national churches, and especially when it comes to funding and giving them control of money.
Okay, so indigenization was, pardon me? I'll let you be the passer. Okay, anyone else? Was an issue that actually a lot of people, I think, Nick, were you interested over here in adding an important lesson?
I thought about the importance of remembering God's sovereignty, mm-hmm. both in individual missionaries' lives, people who didn't, someone like David Brainerd, who didn't know that his main contribution to missions probably would be the written record he left of his own experience. Missionaries who had to wait over, 10, 15 years sometimes before they ever saw anybody come to Christ. Mm-hmm. And then also individual missionaries, God's sovereignty in their work, but also God's sovereignty over the history of missions. At different points, different people contribute different principles, different translations of scripture that will contribute to the work in a country, many years forward. So I thought that a pretty broad understanding of how different ways that God might bear fruit through individual missions efforts, but also the history of missions, was a pretty key theme.
Okay, that's another one. Someone else?
One thing I noticed was it seemed like there was a pattern of a role of a prophetic individual in missions or a prophetic group, in the sense that you have someone who gets a vision, probably from the Holy Spirit, of what God wants to do, but it really challenges and is pretty unsettling to the way people are typically view God's plan and maybe the future and so forth. So you see that certainly with Paul and a lot of the guys we've studied, Carey, you see that too. But it seems like when the Holy Spirit's about to break into something new, he starts with an individual or a small group that really have to play a pretty prophetic role.
Okay. Yeah. So you specifically mentioned William Carey as from history, as a good example of that.
This may seem like a pretty simple and practical lesson, but it's not just the responsibility of the church to send missionaries, but also to send well, to send good missionaries, I guess you could say. And I was thinking of the example of between William Carey and then the guy that he was sent with. Thomas, just as an example of, you know, Thomas was a guy with this like checkered financial past and made many mistakes, but had debt and whatnot. He's a passionate guy, and he was sent alongside Carrie, and Carrie, on the other hand, had this record of like being a stable and consistent worker in the church at home. And both these guys were sent, and within a year, Thomas had, you know, pooped out, and Carrie was, you know, plodding on, continuing. And that's one example, but I think, you know, one thing that also comes up is the history of missions. It just has a checkered history in the sense that there's a lot of failure, and some of that's due, you know, to the conditions, but also some of that's due to, you know, maybe to people who may, in some cases, shouldn't have been the people who were maybe sent in the first place. And so I think that the home church, as we've developed our understanding of what missions is, and what it looks like during our time, it's like I think we have a responsibility to also pick out and really make sure that we're sending our very best, I guess, to the mission field to do that.
Okay, good. We have Kim and then Mike.
Kind of not in contradiction to what you said at all. I don't mean that, but one thing that struck me, just a little slice, was Patrick in Ireland, and how he wasn't a guy with the best theological education, but how God had prepared him, you know, through his time there in slavery, that God had specifically prepared him to go back there, you know, despite a lack of education, that sort of thing, that God was still sovereign in that, and still chose who he wanted to go to Ireland, and that all Patrick had to do was be obedient to that, and that was the thing about him, was that he was so successful because he was so passionate about what he was doing, and that carried him a long way.
Okay. Over here then to Mike.
I was struck by the resolve that these missionaries had, just dead earnest plan to carry out their mission. Like when Judson described winning a convert like pulling out the eye tooth of a live tiger, just what it really took to persist long enough to see that happen. Mm-hmm. Same thing with Carrie's early stretch, those first 4 years, where anybody that I know, including myself, would have quit. Mm-hmm. So just the fortitude and determination that these guys had, the ones that were successful, that struck me.
Okay. They hung in there for the long haul, and that meant that many of them did wait a long while to see that first convert, and even longer often for a big breakthrough. We'll take a couple more, and then we'll, I think we as well want to go back. But you go ahead, and then we'll pass it back to you.
This may sound trivial to some of the Xenos guys I've been hanging out with, but one of the books we read on history of missions talked about, we had a chapter on integral or holistic missions. And I think in our modern church, I see it myself, there's this narrow view of gospel proclamation without actually living life. And you see in these missionaries like Mary Slessor, I mean, they live life with the people that they ministered to. They mm-hmm. were in the nitty-gritty of life, and we've kind of lost that, I think. And mm-hmm. You see in all these missionaries, and they wouldn't think that's anything profound, but somehow we've lost that. And mm-hmm. it's just a valuable lesson I think we need to learn.
That has been an issue that has had some pendulum swings at different times. You know, there was a reaction against the social gospel, so everyone, you know, shies away. And then in the 1970s with the Lausanne Congress and so forth, they reaffirmed the importance. And, you know, then that makes some people uncomfortable. So it is one of these things. It's an important issue, but that has had been at various places, sometimes in reaction to things that are going on. Yes, Chris?
I actually was going to say the very same thing. The word I thought was incarnational, maybe, was mm-hmm. another byword. But what struck me was that this was an indication of the very early church, how distinct they were from the culture mm-hmm. and how they loved one another. So why I thought that was kind of a modern idea, then when I read that it has gone up and down throughout history and was present at the very earliest in terms of how they cared for each other, the whole person, and mm-hmm. what you had said about taking in, you know, the weakest of the weak and the outcast. And
okay, so. Okay. Someone else? All right. We'll make this our last comment because we do have some other things we want to talk about.
Yeah, there are lots of cases where you see theology driving practice, and how people think has dramatic impact on how they approach missions, and in terms of the genuineness of what happened. That's kind of linked also to the a lot of the really successful genuine conversions were related to translation of scripture, putting the scripture into the hands of the people, their language, and that created kind of a sustainable thing.
Yep. Well, the Protestant sola scriptura principle was very much key, and Protestants weren't the only ones, but Catholics as well, but Protestants in much more intentionality, wanting to get scriptures into the indigenous languages. And yes, those are all good lessons, and I hope for some of you. And I hope you can see that actually studying something like missions history should affect how we think. It's not just because we're interested in archaic things, but it actually can be cause us to have a little bit broader view and to not have to reinvent the wheel in every generation. People have learned things in the past that we don't have to relearn all the time because we just don't know our history. So we, in the course, we just finished in the last session talking about William Carey and looking at him. He is a very good example, a very motivational example of many things that he did right. Now we're going to look at briefly at a couple little vignettes, also some good examples. Adoniram Judson and ministry in Burma, as it was called then, and as well as the beginnings of missions in Africa and how that was very much connected with the whole abolition movement. And so it's an interesting thing. I will definitely allow 15 minutes for questions, but I do want to dive into this. And so we'll get going on it. Well, Adoniram Judson, for those who were here for the session on evangelical revival and missions, we talked about this haystack prayer meeting. And that is going to be very influential. And later, that the same man, Samuel Mills, who was the instigator or the motor behind that haystack prayer meeting, is going to form another student association at Andover Theological Seminary. Adoniram Judson is going to be a member of that. Four young theology students are going to approach the Congregational Church and lead to the formation of the first American Mission Board, the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Mission. Adoniram Judson is going to be, this board, they approached the Congregational Church in June of 1810. Already in February of 1812, Adoniram Judson and Samuel Newell are on their way as the first two missionaries from the American church on their way to India. Well, they actually, on the way there, Adoniram Judson knew that he was going to have contact with William Carey and the Serampore Mission. They were, of course, Baptist. So he thought, well, you know what, I'm Congregationalist, Paedo-Baptist, you know, baptizing of infants. And so he thought, I better study this issue so I don't, you know, I can hold my own in any discussion about it. So he and his wife would practice debating, Anne Judson, looking at the scriptures. Well, basically, he ended up, in trying to argue against it, ended up convincing himself of believer's baptism. Took Anne a little longer, but she eventually saw the light. And basically, when he arrived in India, he is going to go to Serampore, and Carey and the Serampore Baptists are going to baptize. He was going to be baptized by immersion by that group. Now that he is a Baptist, he commissioned. He is going to have a central role not only in founding the first mission board of the American church, but also the second mission board. because now that he's a Baptist, he is going to appeal to American Baptists to form the American Baptist Missionary Union, which was formed just a couple years later then. And so he helped to form the first two American mission boards. Well, he went in 1812. Something big happened in 1812, so-called War of 1812. It was not possible for him to serve in India because he was ordered out of it by the British East India Company. So they are going to move on to Burma, where he will basically serve for the rest of his life. Now, Burma was known, you know, these were the days when you went out to the mission field, you never returned, you know, really, in many cases. You know, in some cases, a Hudson Taylor, because of health, went back and forth. But very often, they just went and that was it. Anyway, Felix Carey, the son of William Carey, is going to had tried to establish a Baptist mission in Rangoon. Was not successful, warned them, boy, Burma, because of its Buddhist background, is really hard soil for the gospel. But nevertheless, they went, and yes, the work was slow. It is going to take a number of years, roughly four, until the first Burmese convert is baptized, ironically, in a lotus pond right near an image of Buddha. But over, you know, a little church is going to develop over a number of years. I mean little, like, you know, 15, 20 converts. And then in 1824, the Anglo-Burmese War took place, where Britain is attacking Assam and Bengal. And Adoniram Judson was imprisoned at this time for basically nearly 2 years in horrible conditions. His wife Anne kept him alive by making sure he got some food and going from office to office to try to get him released. He probably survived because of her efforts. She died a few months later at the same time as another little baby of theirs. So yes, very sad. Well, what is going to happen is they are going to realize that the growth in this area is not going to happen among the Buddhists. It's going to happen rather among the animistic hill tribes, minority groups of Burmo-Tibetan ancestry. And Adoniram Judson particularly is going to initially be the first missionary among the Karen people. He's going to first make, you can see on this map, they're kind of located near Rangoon and along the side there. You can see other groups, the Kachin, the Chin, other groups which have now very high proportion of Christians, Baptist Christians, among them. Well, he first made contact with them through a debt slave who he paid the money to ransom. You know, if you didn't have enough money, you became a debt slave. And so if someone paid your debt off, you could be freed. Well, this freed slave was a man named Ko Ta Bu. He was illiterate. He was a thief. He may have murdered as many as 30 people. So we would normally say, not good missionary material, right? Well, anyway, this guy was first freed from his slavery. He is going to be used to sent along with another missionary couple, George and Sarah Boardman, into the Karen area. And at this point, he's not even a believer. He is going to accept Christ in 1828. And he is going to be the motor behind reaching his own people for Christ. So what we're going to see from this lesson, if you want to say, is that though we have all heard of the name, or many of us have heard of Adoniram Judson, Judson College is just down the road from us in Elgin, Illinois, from Chicago. But many of us, have you ever heard of Kotabu? Probably not. But he was a very effective minister, even though he was illiterate. He was had a desire to reach his own people. One unique and interesting fact was that as he came to share with them, it became apparent that there was these traditions of the elders that had a remarkable affinity to elements of the Old Testament. Now, so much so that scholars have wondered if they might have had contact, you know, before they immigrated from China or Tibetan area, if they had had contact with either Jewish or with the Nestorian communities. Because they had an all-powerful creator God, created heaven and earth, a woman being formed from the rib of a man, humanity being tempted by the devil leading to a fall, a Messiah who would come to rescue humanity, and even a prophecy that a white foreigners would come bringing a parchment roll. So all these kind of elements were there, and not too surprisingly, there ended up being a mass movement among the Karen. Among the Buddhists, no, not so much. But within a remarkably short time, they are going to have really mass conversions. I mean, but true conversions. I mean, that's not by 1831. Okay, in 1828, there was only one, Kotabu. By 3 years later, they had a church with 110 baptized members. So there would be more people affiliated, but baptized members. By 1856, 12,000. It's going to continue to grow. It's really a quite amazing story. An interesting part about Judson's missionary method, that's something we like to talk about. He initially decided, like some others, to try to identify himself as a religious teacher by wearing yellow robes. He kind of gave that up pretty soon because he didn't want to be confused with a Buddhist. He changed it to a white robe, and then he kind of gave up because he figured, you know what, I'm going to look like a foreigner no matter what I do. And so he kind of gave up on that. But he did attempt to accommodate other aspects of the gospel and of the two Burmese customs. One thing he did is he would not have a traditional church building. He'd use one of these zayats, these pavilion open air on all sides, which were kind of used as reception halls in Burma. And use them as kind of a drop-in type thing. You know, it looked, this is how other Burmese groups would do things. He attempted to be very careful to preach the gospel and not against Buddhism. And so he wanted to make it relevant to the Burmese mind, but was very careful not to do that. Once again, many of these early missionaries had to do the task of translating the scriptures. He and his wife, Anne, was actually even more gifted in at least conversational Burmese than he was. Actually, Laman Sani from Yale University, African origin, I believe Gambia, he points out that by translating the scriptures into an indigenous language, you are respecting that culture. You are saying this culture is so important and it deserves to have the word of God in your language. And actually, the first ever printed works in Burmese and in many other areas as well were the scriptures. It's the first printed Burmese language ever. And so by 1850, when Adoniram Judson died, 5 million pages of printed and distributed Christian literature had been put into the Burmese language. He is going to realize that we need to use single women missionary. This sounds pretty obvious, but it was actually quite radical at that point. He thought, well, we'll try it. So they had two single women who came, who went and worked alone, not with other white missionaries, alone with Karen Evangelist in these areas that are infested with tigers and all these other kind of things. One of them, Eleanor McCumber, she planted a native Karen church in a remote area with only other Karen workers with her. So actually after this, he's saying, you know what, these women are a good help. So they became more open to using them. Indigenous helpers were very central to their plan. By 1850, they had 114 native preachers. As we said, really the spread of the gospel is being done by the indigenous people themselves. Also, Christian schools were very key to this very successful mission work. So when you say that Adoniram Judson is often referred to as the Apostle of Burma, you know, you have to include all those lesser known indigenous people that did really probably the lion's share of the work. So that's important. I'm going to switch continents. I just to Africa. And we don't have tons of time, but we'll do what we can with what we have. Basically, what we are going to find is that Africa is early along. Let me just preface what I was going to say. Asia was first on the mind of people. That was just the case because colonies were over there and so forth, Portuguese colonies, Spanish colonies, and so forth. So Asia was early on the minds of both the Roman Catholic missionaries and early Protestants. They're going to Asia. Africa gets on the map, if you want to say, with evangelical British, mainly in the beginning, later American missionaries, through the whole abolition movement. It's going to be a key thing. Well, we all know that the abolition of the slave trade is going to be brought about by the active work of evangelical activists. Lots of names you could include. John Wesley in 1774 is, by the way, going to critique some of this language that the Americans have about, you know, freedom at the time of the revolution, when we're not having freedom for the enslaved population. But he is going to bring the whole weight of the Methodist movement, in a sense, behind this concern for abolition. But obviously, who's the big name? Wilberforce, yeah. He was, I hope you've all watched sometime the movie Amazing Grace. It's a good movie. Anyway, it talks about this whole battle in Parliament for abolition. And basically, he entered Parliament at the young age of 21. Is going to spend much of his time advocating for abolition. He's going to be very key in that. Other key events, I'm going through this quickly, was the formation of the Society for the Abolition of the Slave Trade in 1787. Granville Sharp was the first chairman of it. William Wilberforce was an early member. Thomas Clarkson, other names you might have known. By the way, another man, Josiah Wedgwood, porcelain maker. He's the one, Wedgwood designed this motto that was used by American and British abolitionists, "Am I not a man and a brother?" And so this is actually a copy of a Wedgwood porcelain version. We've seen other prints of it as well. So he was involved in that as well. Basically, it's going to be in 1807 that British Parliament is going to declare that the slave trade is illegal. Okay? It's going to be a bit longer in 1833 that all slaves in British colonies are going to be freed. So there's going to be a space of time between those two things. But the reality is the slave trade is going to continue. Now, let me just say something. I believe the year is 1809. The external slave trade to the American colonies, North America, to the United States, ended in 1809. Okay? There was still slave trade, but it was all internal between states. No new ones were allowed in. You can read your Constitution. They allowed for it 20 years after the ratification of the Constitution. So it's not going to the United States. Maybe a few snuck in, but not many. Okay? Where are they all going? The slave trade is going to continue. Actually, it's going to peak in the middle of the 19th century. And it's going to places like Brazil. It's going to places like Cuba. It's being used on Zanzibar. There are clove plantations where even connected with Africa, inside of Africa, in Madagascar, other places, there is going to be slavery continuing. And so this is going to be a little bit of a frustration. It's behind this whole background that missions to Africa are going to be connected with abolitionist goals. With this frustration that though we have achieved abolition and in the British dominions, that the slave trade is still continuing. And so that's what they wanted to deal with. All right. So what are there's going to be other people. They're going to be want to keep, after Wilberforce is going to have retired, other people are going to pick up the banner and go on. One of them is Thomas Buxton, who wrote a very influential pamphlet called The African Slave Trade and its Remedy. Others are going to also be involved in this. He is going to be a key figure as well behind the Society for the Extinction of the Slave Trade and for the Civilization of Africa, 1839. Now, this is going to have as big of a person involved in it as Prince Albert, the husband of Queen Victoria, is going to be a member of the Society for the Extinction of the Slave Trade. So it's going to have, you know, royal aristocrats, a lot of other influential people involved in it. And this is, I'm just going to have a piece from its charter. So it's on the mic. I will read it myself. I highlighted some parts so you can see it easier. It is the unanimous opinion of this society that the only complete cure of all these evils is the introduction of Christianity into Africa. They do not believe that any less powerful remedy will entirely extinguish the present inducements to trade in human beings, or will afford to the inhabitants of those extensive regions a sure foundation for repose and happiness. The present society can take part in no plan of colonization or of trade. Its objects are and must be exclusively pacific and beneficent, but it may, by encouragement and by the diffusion of information, most materially aid in the civilization of Africa and so pave the way for the successful exertions of others, whether they be directed to colonization and the cultivation of the soil, or to commercial intercourse, or to that which is immeasurably superior to them all, the establishment of the Christian faith on the continent of Africa. Just because we're right here at this point, I just would like to have a little reaction to this. Do you feel that this statement, by the way, one of their goals is, they, frankly, the African continent had become dependent upon the slave trade economically. And so the background behind this was a desire to raise an African middle class that is dependent upon another form of commerce, not in human beings. And so they are not going to actively do this. What the Society for the Extinction of the Slave Trade wants to do is be there to provide medical aid, drainage system, if they ask for agricultural help, to give seeds or information, roads and canals and so forth, but actually not do trade itself and not be involved in any colonization in that regard. That being said, how do you feel about this? Any comments? Does this reflect a legitimate, holistic mission? Or is this an unhealthy mixture of development, civilization, and evangelism?
Well, critics would say, for example, imperialism, right, that we've seen in the past civilization.
Well, they didn't exactly say that, but yes, some people would read it that way. They're going to say ultimately Christianity is, they're saying, is the introduction of Christianity, it will create situations where the enslavement of fellow human beings won't take place. Other comments? Yes? Okay. So you would see this as a practical, holistic way to deal with a serious problem, which is the traffic in human lives.
Well, it sounds like the society is about exposure to slavery.
Yep.
They're seeing people
coming to Christ as the only solution to accomplish that purpose. Mm-hmm.
Which I mean, it's pretty good.
It's highlighting
the biggest evil and seeing the gospel as the only solution to solve that problem.
Okay. Other comments?
I like the part where it says,
they did have a view of building up an African middle class. They did want to ultimately, they viewed that as we have to get another, they were concerned about commerce, a other form of commerce. Yeah, we're going to see that David Livingston, he is going to be dead set against. In his area, he could see the slave traders in capturing people, saw horrible things in the 1850s, 1860s, still existing. And he wanted to, in the Zanzibar area, introduce the cultivation of cotton because he wanted to free British industry from being dependent on slave-grown cotton from the United States. If we could have a cotton produced in Africa, not by slaves, then we can get away from having blood money, in a sense, from our cotton mills. You know, what the cotton industry was, of course, huge in Britain. Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, there are two things. They're going to say the introduction to Christianity is absolutely necessary. Without that, nothing will happen. But yes, their main thing is not, I would say, the extinction of the slave trade, you know, is their main thing. One last comment, because I do want to go on. This, of course, is kind of controversial stuff, you know, and so you basically get, yeah, we'll let you be the last. Yeah, well, there really wasn't in that sense. They were trying to build up. Yes, you're right. You can always, I do agree. Let me just go back to the next slide. I do agree that was what they wanted. Christianity had to be first is what they believed. But they wanted, ultimately were willing, you know, to see other forms of commerce to replace the slave trade. Okay, there is going to be a Niger expedition that this Society for the Extinction of the Slave Trade, this was basically a fact-finding mission. They, the Buxton's Society sent 150 people, experts in their field, you know, botanists and agriculturalists. They were going to go into a fact-finding thing, find out what's viable, what can be done, what kind of things would grow, what would, you know, all these kind of different things they were trying to find out. This ended up being a disaster, but not for the reason you might expect. It was a disaster because out of the 150 people, 135 of them got so desperately sick from malaria, about 50 of them died. The remainder were, you know, laid flat. You know, so it was a failure, and actually it put Thomas Buxton, I think unfairly, under a cloud for the rest of his career, because they somehow made him responsible. Well, there's a lot of loss of life, so this kind of got real bad press and the whole nine yards. Okay, anyway, what is going to happen is there is going to be an attempt to develop new trade goods, get the economy not dependent on the slave trade. One big one that actually benefited both the Africans and the British was the use of palm oil. The Africans already used it as a cooking, for cooking, so, I mean, it benefits them. But it also could be used as an industrial lubricant for all the industry in the British, in Britain. So that was, of course, other things like cocoa, ivory for a while, they had to get out of that, and timber and so forth. Yes, so, that is one vignette. We are going to now move to what I view as one of the stellar moments of missions in the 19th century. And it's going to be around a group of people in Sierra Leone. So let's get there. Basically, Sierra Leone, it's the yellow, kind of round Guineas around it. It was founded in 1787 as a refuge for freed slaves from the British Empire. Okay, the United States, next door, they settled Liberia for the same purpose. Okay, Sierra Leone for them, freed slaves. And so there was just a small group of poor blacks, freed blacks from England who arrived there. In the first 5 years, the settlement almost went under. Then in 1792, there was a big influx of black Nova Scotians. These were African Americans who supported the British during the Revolutionary War and had to flee to Canada. And so there was a big group of them, so there were around 1,200 in fact, most of them Baptist, that came. They're going to view themselves in very interesting ways, African Americans using the same kind of languages that the Puritans to New England did, viewing them as themselves as the new Israel, also that they had returned to the continent of their forefathers where they had been taken away in chains. Their identity as Baptist is going to be very clear. Now, one very interesting thing is there was, after the abolition, not the abolition, but the banning of the slave trade in 1807, slave trade, the Royal Navy, the British Royal Navy, patrolled the west coast of Africa and intercepted slave ships and freed the slave population. You know, British ships weren't allowed to do it, but Portuguese were very active in this trade. So in the first year alone, they freed 2,000 slaves who were brought to Sierra Leone, settled in Freetown. Ultimately, there is going to be, in the next couple decades, a total of 74,000 free slaves that are settled in Sierra Leone. Now, these people, so this is a unique story. Did you know about that, that the Royal Navy freed these people? Well, these people were brought there, a vast majority of them. Some of them were Muslim background, but the others that were not of Muslim background, for the most part, converted to Christianity. And they are going to develop their own culture that is kind of a mixture. Scholars estimate that there were probably about 117 different languages represented in Sierra Leone. So they had to form this Creole, it's called Creole, K-R-I-O, this Creole language so that they could communicate, you know. Many of them are, you know, from different people groups there on the west coast of Africa. So they're going to form their own distinct culture, and they, the most famous who we're going to talk about in some detail is a man named Samuel Ajayi Crowther. A very talented and interesting person. Just a couple words about the ministry of the Church Missionary Society. The Church Missionary Society was a mission society from the evangelical branch of the Anglican Church, of the Church of England. And they are going to be working in Africa, in Sierra Leone, from 1804 on. The mission kind of semi-started under a cloud. In the first 20 years, it lost 50 missionaries to disease. They didn't yet know that malaria was spread by the Anopheles, or whatever they call it, mosquito, okay? So, and that you could take quinine and whatever. They didn't know this. People died literally like flies, almost. In fact, I just want you to know, before we get too negative about 19th century missionaries, many of these early missionaries brought their goods in a casket. Many of them died within a year and were buried in that casket. So, yet they still kept coming, knowing the cost that they may pay. And I got to tell you, I don't know too many 21st century people that would do what many of them did. So that's, you know, just need to throw that out there too about them. There, the Church Missionary Society did a lot of good things in this early era. They are going to form a Western-style higher education institute called the Fura Bay College for African leadership in the church. So this was a key institute. And very important, one of its first students to be enrolled was Samuel Ajayi Crowther. He's also going to become one of the first African teachers in the school and a key man. Well, Henry Venn, need to talk about him. He was involved, he was an Anglican clergyman, an evangelical. He was involved in lobbying Parliament for these abolition causes. He kept battering on, don't let the Royal Navy stop patrolling the west coast of Africa. We got to keep those to free the slaves. And so he was involved in that. He was made the secretary, in other words, the leader of the Church Missionary Society for almost, 32 years until his death. He is going to be an early mission strategist who I think many of us would say got a lot right, okay? Got a lot right. Did a very good job. What are some of the things he believed in? Here's what he looked like, okay? Number one, he believed in euthanasia of missions. Well, what does he mean by that? Euthanasia of a mission, this is a quote from him, takes place when a missionary, surrounded by well-trained native congregations under native pastors, is able to resign all pastoral work into their hands and gradually relax his superintendent over the pastors themselves until it insensibly ceases, and so the mission passes into a settled Christian community. So in other words, he is going to say the missionaries are there to work themselves out of a job. He, along a quite similar time, we don't believe that they had contact with another, a man, an American named Rufus Anderson and Henry Venn are both going to propose the three selves that were very crucial in the mission movement. The three selves, what are they? Self-governing. What that basically means is that he uses the word native congregation, okay, so I'm using the words he did, that the native congregations are not under missionary pastors. They are from the get-go raised up to have native preachers. Okay, that is number one. Now, this number two, by the way, is very controversial today. Number two is he believed and put into practice that these native congregations were not to be dependent in any way on foreign money, on money from outside. By the way, we all know people in the third world will say, don't send us your missionaries, just give us your money. By the way, there is a lot of potential problems connected with that issue. And from the get-go, he is going to say, when you are still only a small group Bible study, every meeting of this Bible study, not just of church, you bring your tithe. Whether that, he said, as the way he put it, is only a handful of rice. And so from the get-go, pastors are paid by their congregation and not on, of course, they obviously have to live on. They are not going to be put on the role of the mission and receive a salary from the mission. They will only be paid by their own congregation. You want to send your child to a Christian school, you pay, you have to have it, you have to pay for it yourself. Not a lack of dependency on foreign money. And the principle that the way to reach the natives, the way he would say it, is to have them be self-propagating. In other words, they need to be the ones that are sharing the gospel. So what are the missionaries supposed to do? Well, the missionaries were mentors. He would say he had a very practical plan as to how this thing is going to work. He's going to put it into practice in Sierra Leone and Nigeria with great success. He is going to say, well, you know, from the get-go, when you have a few converts, you meet them together in a home Bible study, and they bring their little bit of rice, or as God blesses them, a little bit more. They would have an occasional visit by a missionary. The missionary would mentor, that's a word we use, they didn't use that word back then, would mentor the leaders of these groups. When you had several of these small home Bible study groups, you made it into a congregation. That congregation could have, because they have from the get-go had a native leader of their home Bible study, one of those leaders would become the pastor of the church. And when you had several churches, you'd arrange yourself into a district, and so it goes on. And before you know it, you have a national church that is totally independent of the Western world. And it was very effective. Well, he is going to put this into practice. He is going to immediately take, there were some churches that had missionary pastors. The missionary pastors were replaced by national pastors. They withdrew all financial support, and it worked. It worked. It worked well. Well, part of his plan, he is going to promote Samuel Crowther. Okay, I'm going to just tell you a little of his story. He is a unique guy. His name was Ajayi. It was quite common. He took, when he was baptized, a English name of an English pastor. He basically was taken as a slave. He was a Yoruba in western Nigeria. He was taken as a slave when he was 13, but he was first a domestic slave in Africa, which was a much better form of slavery. A few years after that, he was sold to Portuguese traders for the international trade, you know, Brazil someplace. He got intercepted. He was a recaptive. He was intercepted by the Royal Navy, freed, brought to Sierra Leone. And he was educated by the British. He went to Fura Bay, converted. He is going to become a teacher at Fura Bay. By the way, I talked about that Niger expedition where so many that ended in kind of a cloud. Samuel Crowther was on it. He is one of the Africans connected with it. Of course, he didn't get malaria like everybody else. Plus, actually, his involvement in the Niger expedition is going to show, you know what, we really need to put Africans. This is actually going to be a piece that is going to convince Henry Venn that we really got to get Africans involved in this. He is then going to be put in charge. He is going to be put in charge of the Yoruba mission. Okay, what this was a bunch of recaptives, accepted Christ, who were originally Yoruba, in other words, from Nigeria. They wanted to have a mission back to Nigeria, to their homeland, because now they have accepted Christ. So Samuel Crowther is made the head of it. His entire staff was African. They had their own mission. They would report to Henry Venn, you know, let him know what's going on. But he was in charge with an entire African staff. And interestingly enough is when Crowther went, he refound his family, was able to leave some of his relatives to Christ, including his mother. And so that was exciting. Natural advantage, these people spoke the language. You know, they were initially from there. So, and then later on, here's the Yoruba, the brown area, large area. Then later, he is going to be put in charge of the mission in the Niger Delta, where he's once again going to have the entire staff under his control. And basically, he's not only going to be the leader of Venn's native pastorate, he is, in 1864, going to be elected as, he had, by the way, been, in the meanwhile, ordained in England as an Anglican, as an Anglican minister, and he was in 1864 elected as the first African Anglican bishop. And so, this was a great moment in missions, with Henry Venn have as a mission strategist, really thinking through some things and really getting indigenous leadership involved in it, and a Samuel Crowther being a kind of one of the key missionaries we like to look up to as a key type of person. Unfortunately, this story has a sad ending. What happened is, after Henry Venn died, there was, to quote Mark Shaw, you know, like as to why this had to happen, a new breed of missionary coming. By the way, this is now in the imperial era for Africa. Prior to that, that was prior to it. Really, the conquest of Africa happened after the Berlin Conference in 1884. In this period of time, there was a new, more racist, paternalistic form of missionary than this scientific racism is becoming more common in Europe and in the United States than previously. So what it started as a wonderful story is actually going to end up with, piece by piece, these Africans who are in control are going to be called into question, distrusted by this new group of missionaries, and removed one by one until actually the African leadership is going to be entirely eliminated and put back into the hands of British missionaries. Which is a very sad story. Very sad ending to a good story. So, that's what I have to share. That leaves us hopefully with some food for thought. And we can open it up for questions. We got like 12 minutes.
And the last thought, that racial component, was that because of Darwinism teaching?
A lot of that was happening, that social Darwinism, this belief that social Darwinism is an application of evolutionary thought to various cultures. In other words, that the white race is superior, and therefore it is going to justify the domination of lower races. Yeah, that was related to that.
Second question. Is there any evidence of like a Catholic church in Africa already doing any missions? Is that existing?
I am not aware of Coptic missions. They tended to be pretty ingrown. They survived, but tended to be pretty ingrown. Yeah. Other?
Yeah, when you were talking about Judson, you said that he preached the gospel, but he didn't preach against Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
How did the gospel survive, or did like people keep their idols around him? And how was it that became Christians? I just wondered if you could tell me a little bit more what you meant by that.
What I meant was I'm sure that they did not. Okay. What I mean was, some people, he was trying to preach, you know, it's like when frankly, if you're trying to reach a Roman Catholic for Christ, you're not going to preach against Mary and those things. You're going to stress the positive aspects of the gospel. And my understanding of what he did is that he is stressing the positive aspects of the gospel and allowing these other implications, instead of preaching specifically that this part of Buddhism, a very polemical approach, that this part of Buddhism is wrong. So, he's in the sense, yeah, that's how it. Well, to be frank, they may well have had. Like I say, the real growth did not take place among the Buddhists anyway. The real growth in Burma is among the non-Buddhist population. And the Buddhists remain, in many countries, very resistant to the gospel. Yeah?
Along the lines of what he said, it's similar to Paul's teaching to the Athens, their unknown God.
Mm-hmm.
He became one of them to teach the Athens about Christ, as Judson did with the people of India,
mm-hmm.
with the Buddhism and all that.
Okay. Yes, back there. Well, you know, we hate to, you're always getting in trouble if you make it only one way. I like Mark Shaw, he wrote a short history of the church in Africa called The Kingdom of God in Africa, Mark Shaw. And, you know, I think his analysis is correct, that there is a new breed of missionary that came in. Did that breed last into the 20th century? Yes, probably. Did that mean that everyone was that way? No. One thing I think we need to recognize is that missionaries tended to be less racist than Europeans at home. Now, why would that be the case? Well, they come, you know, maybe they arrived with some racial preconceptions, but as you, you know, as you work and live with people for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, you come to appreciate their culture. And so actually, they were a lot less racist than the majority of people back in their home churches. So did they make mistakes? Yes, some people made mistakes more than others. But yes, one mistake that probably happened more than racism among missionaries is what we call paternalism. And that is the view that, you know, I'm like your father, I know better than you do what you need to do. That's a way of disrespecting people. And so that probably was more common than true racism, that most people didn't last on the mission field in Africa very long before they got over that. You know, in fact, it's interesting, some of our students have read a biography about Mary Slessor. She was this fiery little missionary who went to West Africa, parts of what today are Nigeria. And, you know, her earlier statements would sound a bit more racist than as time went on. And she was she is now very respected by the Nigerians for all she did. She ended up serving there, I don't know the exact figure, but roughly 50 years as a missionary there. And, you know, so yes, there will be variations of how missionaries were. It is very common in we need to guard from two extremes. One is to over glorify former missionaries. The other is to normally make them overly blacken them. In former days, we used to over-glorify them. That has not been true for quite a while, okay? Now there is a tendency to overly go too far the other way. We're influenced by our popular culture that gives us this kind of thing without much true historical documentation. It's more of a gut feeling type stuff. And so, yeah. Yes?
Henry Venn's view on the euthanasia of missions.
Yeah.
So was there like a common expectation of how long that transition would take place, or like an average amount of time? Because it seems like it's easier said than done, right? So.
Well, it's easier said than done, particularly if you're trying to change a mission where everybody's already used to having a lot of missionary help, and they say, oh, we can't do it, we can't pay our own way, you know, and so forth. That's harder. His goal, if you noticed, was to start from the get-go. You teach them tithing real early in your small group Bible study. You learn these things from day one. You get the expectation that you are going to have a native pastor, even if, quote, the missionary can preach better, you know, because he's more educated or knows the scripture better. You know, it's easier if... to do if you start from ground up, and that's the way they want it to do. We're going to talk tomorrow in our class about the example of Korea. And one of the explanations, there's other explanations we're going to talk about. One of the explanations for the exponential growth of the Korean church is because they put these three selves into practice, including not receiving support from Westerners. That is one key thing that has, it's not the only thing, there's going to be other things we're going to talk about that are reasons for the exponential growth. Well, I'll just throw one other out. Well, I'll save it for tomorrow so I don't ruin my thunder, steal my thunder, whatever. Any other questions? Yes. Well, there are some perils that you can, on the surface, that you can see. In terms of parallelism, you'd probably have to unpack all the various components connected with it. One difference I would, I guess I could see some parallels going on there between those. Other questions? Nobody have any comments or questions about, I threw it out there provocatively, about support from the of Western money for missions. I threw it out there hoping to challenge your thinking. Yes.
With the people there, especially when they're aware of first world wealth, they know that they can hunt around and probably get support from other areas, from other white guys.
Yep. They do know about that. Yep.
I'm from Chile. When there's more civilization, there's more rights, there's more education, stuff like that, than that time. But the idea, though people know that the Westerners, the whites from the north, have more money, if you really start from scratch with the mindset of we're going to actually build a church ourselves and we don't need buildings and stuff, that does work out and you don't need a lot of money.
It is harder when they've already been used to something. That is definitely true. Definitely true. To wean them off the flow of money there is really hard when they've been used to it. And you're right. If you turn them down on money, they'll go to church X, Y, or Z, and they'll probably, if they have a good enough, you know, appeal, probably can find some money from church X, Y, or Z. So basically, one of the big issues is a lot of these people are spending so much time trying to get the money from X, Y, or Z that maybe their energy is being diverted from developing a self-sustaining ministry at the level of the church. Now, theoretically, if you have 10 tithing members, you can support a pastor, because if the pastor is living on the same level as his congregants, theoretically, okay? But, you know, in many cultures, they have already had the idea that if I'm a pastor, you know, I'm supposed to have a fancy car, and I'm supposed to have this, and I'm supposed to have that, you know? And basically, it worked here. It was an earlier era, I know that. They didn't have as much instant communication of what's going on, but it's an important question relevant to the whole missions thing. And it raises a lot of, you know, it's an important question. Yes? Well, in some sense, welfare is a form of dependency. And if you are dependent, let's face it, if a indigenous church is independent, that ought to give them great pride. And frankly, whoever holds the money holds the strings of power, ultimately. Because you're going to have to do what pleases, you know what I'm saying. And that might not always be the best thing for whatever your ministry is. And so it is very interesting, this concept of self, these three selves, back in, 1850s, are still have relevance for today, are much more radical than many people today are willing to go. and yet have been connected with very, well, like this example in Sierra Leone and Nigeria, very good, and possibly we could throw in Korea, very good, strong, healthy indigenous churches. I got to end with that. Thank you for coming.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.